U.S. threats to invade Greenland are also threats to NATO.
This is an unprecedented situation we've never had in NATO history.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today we get the European perspective on Washington's designs on Greenland. Also, protected status for Somali refugees in the U.S. is ending. They could now be sent back to Somalia.
My biggest worry is what to tell to my mother. She's sitting in a locally displaced camp in Mogadishu, Somalia, and she's more worried than I am.
Plus, a big game for an amateur tennis player in Australia, and the Netherlands bans fireworks. Could be a lonely fight.
A lot of people will go to Germany, to Belgium, to Poland, to all the other countries to get fireworks because all the borders are open.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in today. We begin in Washington, where Vice President J.D. Vance hosted a closed-door meeting at the White House with top diplomats from Denmark and Greenland. On the agenda, the future of Greenland.
President Trump is not backing away from his threats to seize Greenland, which is a semi-autonomous part of Denmark. But Greenland's leaders, along with their counterparts in the European Union, are less than thrilled with the idea of a U.S. takeover, to say the least. The World's Matthew Bell begins our coverage.
As the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland were meeting with Vice President Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the White House tweeted a cartoon. It shows two dog sleds bearing the flag of Greenland with a fork in their snowy path ahead. On one side is the White House with an American flag blocking out the sun. On the other, a night sky with a bolt of lightning and the flags of China and Russia. The caption says, quote, "Which way, Greenland man?" On Tuesday, Greenland's Prime Minister, Jens Frederik Nielsen, seemed to be drawing a line in the snow of his own. First of all, Greenland is not for sale, Nielsen said, and he continued. Greenland does not want to be owned by the U.S., governed by the U.S., and Greenland will not be part of the U.S., the Prime Minister said. Greenland is part of the Kingdom of Denmark. This morning, President Trump was asked by a reporter to respond to Prime Minister Nielsen's statement.
Well, that's their problem. That's their problem. I disagree with him. I don't know who he is, don't know anything about him, but that's going to be a big problem for him.
Trump also put out a statement on social media this morning saying the U.S. needs Greenland and that anything less is unacceptable. Denmark's foreign minister is Lars Løkke Rasmussen. He attended the White House meeting with Vance and Rubio and spoke to reporters outside the Danish embassy in Washington. He said the meeting was frank but also constructive, and he acknowledged that the two sides still have a fundamental disagreement.
For us, ideas that would not respect territorial integrity of the Kingdom of Denmark and the right of self-determination of the Greenlandic people are, of course, totally unacceptable.
Rasmussen said the Danish government hopes to continue talking with the Trump administration about the way forward. He pointed to Denmark's 225 years of friendly diplomatic ties with the United States. He said his government shares concerns about Greenland's security and that it is expanding its own military footprint there. But he said the U.S. already has wide military access to build up its own forces under a Cold War defense agreement.
The U.S. can always ask for increasing its presence in Greenland. And therefore, we wish to hear if the U.S. had any further requests to make in this aspect. We would examine any such request constructively.
In the U.S. Senate, some relevant legislation has just been introduced. It would prevent the Trump administration from using taxpayer dollars to blockade, occupy, annex, or otherwise assert control over the territory of any other NATO member state. Kentucky Republican Mitch McConnell weighed in on the issue today. He said he has yet to hear from this administration a single thing we need from Greenland that this sovereign people is not already willing to grant us. McConnell went on to warn the Trump administration against committing, quote, an unprecedented act of strategic self-harm. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
For more on what the U.S. stance on Greenland means for NATO, we turned to Carlo Masala in Munich. He's a professor of international politics at the Bundeswehr University. He said the situation presents a totally new challenge.
I mean, this is the first time that the leading NATO member threatens another NATO ally with the use of force to get part of its territory. This is an unprecedented situation we've never had in NATO history. And if the U.S. administration should rely on force to take Greenland, then actually this is the end of NATO. I mean, NATO has no mechanism to deal with military conflicts among its members. NATO was set up to deal with external threats and external military threats for its members. But if the biggest alliance member use force to take some territory of a smaller NATO ally, actually this is the end of NATO.
Let's say that it does not come to that, and there is more of a diplomatic resolution to this current conflict. What damage has already been done to NATO because of U.S. threats to Greenland and the tension that has arisen?
I think that the Trump administration has done a major blow to Article 5 and the credibility of Article 5.
Article 5 is the one that says, a strike to one of us is a strike to all.
Yeah, this is the core of NATO. This is the core of the Washington Treaty, where basically it is a promise that in case of an external attack, all NATO members would come to the defense of the NATO country which has been attacked.
Right.
If basically one NATO member, and especially the US as the biggest NATO member and most important NATO member, now issues a military threat against one of its partners, how credible is it that it's going to defend other smaller NATO members if they're going to be attacked from the outside? So there is, an incredible backlash the U.S. administration has produced with regard to Article 5. So because we're living in a time where especially the Baltic countries are afraid that if the war of Russia against Ukraine is over, they might be the next victim of a Russian aggression. So to what extent can they still believe that the U.S. will come to their defense if they are going to be attacked in the future?
Mm. So this has larger repercussions beyond just what is happening in Greenland right now.
Absolutely. It's really about the future of the alliance.
The official response from NATO to President Trump's comments about Greenland has been somewhat muted. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte has said Greenland's security is, quote, non-negotiable. Why isn't NATO speaking out on this more aggressively? Is it just trying to keep in the U.S.'s good graces?
The problem for the Europeans is that they need the U.S. with regard to Russia's war against Ukraine. And they need the U.S. as some sort of security provider for Europe. They are afraid that if they speak up with regard to Greenland, the U.S. or Trump himself might basically then tell them that they have to deal with Russia and the Ukrainian war just by relying on their own diplomatic initiatives and their military means. Mm. So basically, there is a trade-off. What is more important, to keep the U.S. engaged in the Ukrainian talks or Greenland? And I think most of NATO's members already decided that Ukraine is more important than Greenland.
Mm, interesting. NATO countries agreed last summer to boost defense spending to 5% of GDP by 2035. Are they now able to defend themselves and Ukraine without the U.S. if they had to come down hard on this and they lost U.S. support for the war in Ukraine?
If the U.S. would decide in the next, let's say, 2 or 3 years to basically pull out of Europe, Europe wouldn't be able to defend itself against any form of large-scale Russian aggression. Because we are in the process of rearming ourselves, but this takes time. Because if you buy a tank or if you order a tank, you will get it in 2 to 3 years. So it is a process where we still need a couple of years to be able to defend ourselves against any form of external aggression. That's basically the problem of the Europeans. If the U.S. would by tomorrow decide that they no longer be the security provider for Europe, Europe would be in deep, deep trouble.
Mm. I'm speaking with Carlo Masala, a NATO expert and professor at the Bundeswehr University in Munich. I was interested to see that in a speech yesterday, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said that the U.S. is absolutely committed to NATO. This was in relation to comments about increasing defense spending for European countries and others. Do European leaders believe that the U.S. is absolutely committed to NATO?
No, I don't think so. Most of European leaders don't believe this any longer. There are a couple of European countries who still do believe that. I'm just coming back from Poland, where basically, you know, the political elite or parts of the political elite still believe that the US is committed to European security and to NATO. But if you talk to French politicians, Germans, even British politicians, they all realize that you can't trust the US any longer. And this is exactly what our Chancellor Merz a couple of months ago said, that you can't trust the US any longer to be a reliable ally.
Mm. He said last month that Pax Americana, this US-led world order, is largely over for Europe. If that's true, what sort of new world order are we transitioning into?
Well, actually, I think we are transitioning into a new world order, which will be, at the end of the day, a bipolar one, where the two, let's say, superpowers of the international system are the US and China, with the difference from the old bipolar world order between the US and the Soviet Union, that actually both China and the US don't consider partners as important in pursuing their national interests. So all these countries who are in between then have to decide whether basically to pay for security, either by the US or by China, but won't play any role on a global scale because the world is going to be dominated by these two superpowers, China and the US.
When we talk about Europe, what tools do the Europeans have, if it would come to this, to counter US aggression in Greenland?
Honestly, none. I mean, what Europe can do is they can start sanctioning U.S. politicians. They can start sanctioning U.S. companies. But the question is, what kind of retaliatory measures will the U.S. then take? And I think at the end of the day, Europe won't do anything if the U.S. takes over Greenland in one way or the other, because it lacks the instruments and it's still too dependent economically and politically from the U.S.
You mentioned sanctions and things like that. Even if Europe is not strong enough militarily to counter the U.S., do you think that as one of the world's largest economies taken together, the EU, it would have power to check U.S. actions?
Well, it has at least the power to harm U.S. economic interests in Europe. Yeah? And then the question is whether the Trump administration would change course then or would start a kind of trade war with Europe.
So we're talking today primarily about what is happening with Denmark, Greenland, and the U.S. But of course, the larger backdrop here is the war between Russia and Ukraine. I'm wondering how this latest news sits with you against this backdrop of this larger war in Europe.
Well, actually, what we see right now that, I mean, the U.S., of course, but also Europe is now concerned with Greenland, and Ukraine is somehow put on the back burner. The second thing is, I think that U.S. actions with regard to Greenland are weakening the whole policy of deterring Russia with regard to any kind of future aggression against a European NATO member. And the third thing, and this we have to see, is how are the negotiations between the U.S. and Moscow being affected by what is happening in Greenland? Because rumors says that I think Witkoff and Kushner, anytime soon, they want to go to Moscow to talk to their counterparts. So we still don't know what kind of effect this policy with regard to Greenland and Venezuela and probably even Iran will have on U.S.-Russian relations with regard to finding a solution for this war.
President Trump has been in office for his second term for nearly a year. I'm wondering if you could step back for a moment and reflect on how his foreign policy overall is shifting the world order.
Well, actually, his foreign policy is bringing the liberal world order we used to have from the end of the Second World War until recently. It's bringing it to an end. I mean, we are moving into probably a world order where the only countries which matter are the big powers. I mean, as I said, China, probably a bit Russia in Europe and the US. And international relations probably in the next couple of years will resemble much more international relations we know from the 18th and 19th century. I mean, this kind of great power concerts, rather than the world order which had been established and led by the US after the end of the Second World War.
Carlo Masala is the author of If Russia Wins. He joined us from Munich.
Stay tuned to hear about changes in international adoption. That's coming right up. You're listening to The World.
Right now, we are living through some of the most tumultuous political times our country has ever known. I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll try to make sense of what's happening alongside politicians and thinkers like Cory Booker, Nancy Pelosi, Liz Cheney, Tim Walz, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Newt Gingrich, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Charlemagne the God, and so many more. That's all in the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The vast majority of children up for adoption around the world never end up getting adopted. That's partly because over the past 20 years, many countries have banned international adoption. The world's Maria Noble Valdez wanted, as an adoptee herself, to know more about why so few kids find adoptive families.
I was adopted from St. Petersburg, Russia, 18 years ago when I was 5 years old. It may be hard to believe, but I have a memory of my life before and during the adoption process. And as adoptions go, my parents have told me mine had some hurdles and bureaucracy, but it proceeded over 3 years as smoothly as you would hope. But these days, international adoptions are practically frozen.
I really felt like I had to jump through all of these hoops for the government. Yet when it came down to it, they were unwilling to help in any manner.
Michelle Reed lives in Florida. She actually worked for an adoption agency when she began the process of adopting three boys from Haiti about 9 years ago. The brothers lived in an orphanage in Port-au-Prince. Given the gang violence going on in Haiti at the time, she thought she and other families trying to adopt orphans, or even extended family, from the country would have support from Congress. But she says the message they all got from U.S. officials was shocking.
A complete lack of empathy for our situations. They wanted to follow what they saw the law as to a T, yet we were emailing them the laws and the adoption laws of Haiti that showed very clearly that there was a pathway for our children to come out and become citizens immediately, and they would not consider it.
Despite constant letters being written by families and even congressmen in support of bringing the children home, she was told to wait it out and encourage the kids to shelter in place. At one point, the Department of State under the Biden administration told her something she says she will never forget.
And this was in writing as well. We cannot provide emergency assistance to U.S. citizens in the country, but we can repatriate remains.
Reed was able to bring her boys home one by one between 2022 and earlier last year. Her story is not unique among U.S. families attempting inter-country adoptions. Ryan Hanlon says the global adoption system is failing on many fronts.
Part of it's going to depend on how one defines orphan, but there are very few adoptions globally relative to the number of children who are living without parents.
Hanlon is the president of the National Council for Adoption, a U.S.-based adoption research and support organization. He says there's no universal definition of what an orphan is. In some cases, an orphan is a child who has lost their parents. Sometimes, it's a kid with one or both parents still living, but is facing severe neglect.
What strikes me as maybe relevant for the context of a conversation around adoption is a child who's living permanently outside of parental care, so they're in some type of an institutionalized setting or non-permanent family setting, and you know the birth parents are either deceased or unavailable for some reason, like they're incarcerated, or there has been some type of a choice where they've relinquished parental rights or parental rights have been terminated.
Perhaps the biggest complication in adopting into the U.S. is navigating the legal process and the paperwork. I had a conversation about that with Diane Coons. She is the executive director of the National Council for Adoption.
I always use the analogy of an Oreo cookie. You start with the chocolate part at the top is the American requirements to be able to adopt a child. In the middle is the sending country requirements. And then you go back to American requirements, because as you know from your own experience, just because you adopt a child does not mean they're a citizen. And we have had very upsetting cases, and this is something we've worked on very hard to change, that tens of thousands of adopted children never became citizens.
Coons is an adoptive mother and a lawyer. Once a corporate attorney, she now works to help families adopt from overseas.
I mean, my four adopted children had three different paths for citizenship. And I'm a lawyer. So, you know, the one thing they had was their citizenship right away. But there's three different rules because of the time. The child born in 96 had one set of rules, and then the law kept changing.
Another massive challenge? Politics. Ryan Hanlon says some nations stopped allowing Americans to adopt children because of a handful of abuse cases decades ago. Since those cases, new laws have been passed to make sure adoptees are safe.
For the Netherlands to say they don't want to do modern day adoptions because they don't like what happened in the 1980s is foolish. It doesn't take into account the modern realities, the modern practices, and certainly isn't responsive to the needs of present day children.
Remember how I said I was adopted from Russia? Well, my parents took me home just in time. Because since 2012, Russia has been one of the places that stopped inter-country adoptions for U.S. citizens. It came after Congress sanctioned Russia for the murder of a prominent attorney who exposed massive fraud. Diane Coons of the National Council for Adoption says that made the attorney, Sergei Magnitsky, an enemy of Vladimir Putin.
I do believe that Putin and his inner circle rooted around for something to do that would be painful and hurtful to Americans, and banning adoption from the United States was.
Russia maintains the ban is to protect children from abuse in the United States. Other countries, including China, Guatemala, Ethiopia, Cambodia, and Nepal, have banned international adoptions as well. The vulnerability of the process to political winds and bureaucratic red tape is staggering. Reflecting on the flaws in the adoption process, it's really a miracle that I was adopted when I was. For The World, I'm Maria Noble Valdez.
Imagine this. You are a weekend tennis warrior who has just defeated a pro. I know it's far-fetched, but stay with me here. You beat the world's number two men's player, Jannik Sinner, and the number four women's player, Amanda Anisimova. Now you're in the finals of the competition, and a single point could change your life.
One of them will be $1 million richer.
As you might have gathered, that's real. Amateur tennis player Jordan Smith made it to the finals of the one-point slam ahead of the Australian Open in Melbourne. The competition matched up men and women, professionals and amateurs. The whole objective is to win a single point. For the championship match, Smith stepped onto the court to face Joanna Garland from Taiwan. She's ranked 117th in women's tennis.
He's won $1 million!
$1 million in Australian currency. That's close to 700,000 US. As you could hear, everyone was pretty shocked. The 29-year-old Smith is an amateur athlete, but he is not inexperienced. He won national titles as a junior player.
Smith says he's going to buy a house with the prize money.
More global stories are coming your way. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration is ending temporary protected status for Somalis in the U.S. The announcement means the hundreds, possibly thousands, of Somali immigrants with TPS have just 2 months to leave the country or face deportation. President Trump has put a glaring spotlight on Somali Americans. He's called them garbage, saying they come from hell and contribute nothing. Add to that the current investigation by federal agents into fraud in Minnesota, allegedly perpetrated by, among others, people of Somali descent. It's all been concerning for Somali American Abdi Nor Iftin. He survived Somalia's civil war, then came to this country after winning the visa lottery in 2014 and wrote a memoir about the experience, Call Me American. We reached him today in Maine and asked him how he's doing now.
It has become very, very normal for me to wake up every day and go to my social media accounts and see Somali on handcuffs. A lot of the Somali community members in Minnesota are, you know, sharing those photos as they are meeting ICE face to face. No one has ever actually expected that we would be facing the, you know, this kind of a go back home. My biggest worry is what to tell to my mother. She calls me every day. She's sitting in a locally displaced camp in Mogadishu, Somalia, and she's more worried than I am. And so I'm trying to come up with all the excuses to tell her, you know, I'm a naturalized citizen, mother. I don't really have much to worry about, but I never know what's going to happen next.
There are these videos of Somalis who've been deported who are sent back. And I know your mother, when she sees those videos, what does she think?
There's obviously hundreds of Somalis that are sent back to Somalia, you know, coming off these airplanes. But what's making things even much worse is that some of these people that are being deported from the United States going back to Somalia are famous. Like, we're talking about someone on TikTok who's used to, you know, coming live and chat with the community. I can give you one example. There's a gentleman, pretty famous. His name was Gadia Khan. Actually, he ended up on the X account of Homeland Security, and they posted his picture as, you know, being deported.
And who is he and why is he famous?
He's a social media influencer, and he's one of the people that came through the southern border when President Biden was in office, and he's documented his entire journey. It's a dangerous trip through the Darien Gap, and he ended up going back to Somalia. And so when people like my mother and friends and, you know, community members back home and even here in the United States, when they see that kind of deportation process that's happening to those of us within the Somali community that are sort of celebrities, famous, you know, so everyone really assumes that you could be next.
What is it like for you to watch those videos of Somalis who've been deported back home?
It obviously, I moved here and I wrote a book and I thought, hey, you know, I've made it here and it's okay. You know, the worries are gone, right? But it's not really quite true.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says conditions have improved in Somalia, and that's why Somalis no longer qualify for TPS. Having stayed in close touch with friends and relatives back in Somalia, I mean, is the country safe now? What do you hear from folks back in Mogadishu?
Well, it's interesting. If you go to the United States State Department, Somalia is still level 4, extremely dangerous. Do not travel. I mean, I'm not making this up. Anybody can go on the State Department and look at that. So there's a group, Al-Shabaab, which is a pretty radical group that's been attacking the government positions, and they're still there. They're pretty active. The government is doing its best, but it really hasn't done enough to make people back home feel safe and for those of us here to be able to go back and peacefully, you know, reconnect with our family members. So at this point, I don't think it's actually safe at all for anybody who's left Somalia to go back to Somalia.
Abdi, there is the intense ICE presence in Minnesota's Twin Cities. There's also this federal investigation into fraud allegedly committed by people of Somali descent. What are you hearing from your social circles there about the mood right now?
Yes, there is certain members of the Somali community who have done fraud. Actually, that's out there, and there's evidence in Minnesota. But there's over 80,000 Somalis living in Minnesota. And sometimes the narrative seems to be turning the entire community as thieves, right? People who defrauded the government. I know the community, a lot of members of the community are working hard, even if English is not their first or second or third language. You know, they work hard, paying the bills, getting their kids to school. But unfortunately, this entire narrative has really covered up their hard work and their contribution to the United States.
Are the allegations of fraud and this federal investigation, is that dividing the Somali American community in Minnesota?
It is. Absolutely, it is. I know a large group, probably growing number of Somalis who are saying, we shouldn't be hush about it. We should talk about fraud and who did it. Being quiet can mean complicit in the entire community. So I hear that as well.
Yeah, I mean, and is there concern about speaking out right now about what's going on?
It can be. Actually, it seems to be that the country, the United States, which I've lived in now for nearly 12 years, we're drifting apart, right? We're Now, being a Somali depends on who's seeing you. You know, if it's, you know, half of the country just sees me as a person who's not American, not patriotic. So I've been trying to fight that back and say, a lot of us are actually love being here and assimilate and just do things like I do. I go hiking, skiing. I do all kinds of things that Americans love, like eating hot dogs, you know. And so I've been trying to get that story out personally. It's not that, you know, we're in a bubble. And then there's part of the community that are just unable to communicate in English. I've been connecting with Minnesota. I've actually traveled back and forth to Minnesota a lot because I have friends there. And it is true. If you look at a number, a lot of the Somali community members are actually dependent on welfare. It is true. But why is that? You might be asking. It is because most of them have arrived through the refugee program back in the Bush era, you know, even Clinton era, and mostly because the parents and the kids were the most vulnerable. And so those had to come here, and parents have had, had a hard time trying to learn English. And so the way this story is told is actually not quite honest. So I see there's a lot of work that we have to do, like people like me who are multilingual, come from the Somali community, but also understand America a little bit, to talk about the hardworking community, members of the community that are everywhere in the United States.
Is the Somali community in Maine also finding itself a target of pressure from ICE? Like, what are you seeing on a local level?
There's ICE in Maine. Actually, a couple of days ago, but I was driving on the highway and there was an ICE car in front of me and sort of heading out to Lewiston, Maine is where predominantly the Somalis and other immigrants are. Mm. And there's a sighting or two or three, you know, activities going on every day. I'm getting concern from members of the community who I'm in group chat with, you know, who are saying, what is best to do? You know, do you have to run? Do you have to hide? Do you have to not open the door? And so we're having that conversation. And there are a lot of lawyers in Maine who are also volunteering to go out, help the community, and we appreciate the work that they're doing.
It is remarkable, though, that you're having these what-if conversations. You wrote in your memoir, Abdi, Call Me American, about your love for the U.S. as a child. This country was an idea and a dream for you when you were growing up in Somalia, a country at war. I'm just wondering, where did that dream come from?
It came from out of desperation. Growing up in the civil war in Somalia as a child, there was no school. We played soccer all day long and hide and seek at night. My mom was sleeping out on the street and I joined her. And that's not a life that any human being would really want to live in, right? And the Marines have arrived. Some of the audience members might have seen Black Hawk Down from the American perspective. But I was there for that. I was one of those kids that just run around, saw the helicopters, and just went every direction because it was like watching a real action movie. And shockingly, that's where it started, right? It's just, where are these guys from? I really want to see, you know, that kind of child curiosity. And then all these action movies, Hollywood movies, and, you know, pop culture. There was all this American music that just came into Somalia. And this is way before Al-Shabaab, so at least we had freedom to listen to music and watch movies. And by 2006, and Al-Shabaab took over the country and they bombed the movie theater and they basically forbid everything that I really enjoyed, including movies and soccer. And, you know, and then that's when I decided to leave Somalia, just because my freedom, the little freedom that I had, you know, disappeared. And I came all the way here many, many years later to find freedom. And I guess justice and live happily. And I'm not really sure if that's there now as I speak.
Well, I was just about to ask you, what is it like for someone like you who experienced a sudden collapse of society and this eruption into violence and vulnerability to be experiencing this moment of instability in the U.S.?
May I use the word betrayal, actually? You know, that's the way it feels. I really wanted to be treated as American. I worked hard to become naturalized. I even celebrated. I ended up on the TV, you know, raising my right hand, taking the oath of naturalization. It brought tears to my eyes, you know, when I raised my right hand. And it just made me feel connected and love this country even more, right? And I really, really, really hope President Donald Trump and his group just see that, you know, how emotional it can be for some of us immigrants who went through hell, civil war, an Islamic regime, and then eventually going through all those odds just to get here to become free and live a normal life. And I really hope people see that aspect of the story as well.
I can imagine you were and probably still are not the only Somali who'd like to come to the U.S., but how different is that perspective in Somalia today?
I do not know a single person in Somalia who actually wants to come to the United States. You know, it's the opposite. I think they're asking us to leave immediately as fast as we can, because what they hear in the news is scary. People have social media. People are looking at the videos from Minnesota. Somalis handcuffed, people getting shot. They're looking at that, you know, and they're saying, well, at least that is not what we have here, right, in Somalia. And that's pretty much the message that my mother's trying to send. You know, she really thinks that I might disappear. Someone going to grab me and take me away. And I haven't, for the record, I haven't seen my mother in 16 years. That's a long time.
Wow.
And she does not want me to disappear or something happen to me without seeing her again. And so I can understand where she's coming from. And I don't really know what words to use to comfort her, because the videos and the photos and the stories that she sees and on the news is just enough to give her, I guess, long sleepless nights.
Somali-American Abdi Nur Iftin won the visa lottery in 2014. His memoir about his experience is Call Me American. Abdi, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
U.S. troops have seized a total of 5 oil tankers accused of evading U.S. sanctions. Video showed one seizure where soldiers used a helicopter to board a ship called the Olena, which was flying the flag of Timor-Leste. The sanctioned tankers are part of a so-called shadow fleet of vessels. Their ownership is obscured, so the ships can transport oil from Russia, Iran, or Venezuela in defiance of Western sanctions. As Duri Buscarin reports for The World, the shadow fleet impacts conflicts on both sides of an ocean.
Okay, so I'm sitting at my computer in Istanbul, and on this side of the screen, I have this ship tracking website pulled up. This is a real-time look at every oil tanker in the water near me. And on the other side of my screen, I have this Excel spreadsheet of ships that have been sanctioned for transporting Russian, Iranian, or Venezuelan oil. And surprisingly, or probably not surprisingly, there are sanctioned tankers all over the place. Right here is the Sea Viking. It's waiting in the Marmara Sea to sail up the Bosphorus Strait. And then on the other side, there's the Walrus that's hanging out at a port in the Black Sea. And when you try to figure out where they're going next...
That's GPS jamming, that mess that you see there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Michelle Wiese-Bachmann is a maritime intelligence analyst for Windward AI. She says these ships are a prime target for Ukrainian drone strikes in the Black Sea. So on her screen, there's a jumble of lines that look like they've been scribbled over a Russian port.
This is done by Russia in order to mess up all the navigation signals. It's to prevent drone attacks on their refineries. So you can see any ship that's been in that area is having its signal jammed.
Other times, a ship might turn off its transponder entirely. When Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, G7 countries, including the US, Germany, and Japan, agreed to cap the price of Russian oil. The idea was to reduce Russia's oil profits and its ability to fund the war in Ukraine. So Russia started buying up aging oil tankers to transport its oil anonymously. And this became the Shadow Fleet.
The growth of the shadow fleet is the single biggest phenomenon that has allowed Putin to keep raking in money for his energy exports. And so it's absolutely critical to understanding what's been going on.
Robin Brooks is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. As he tried to track down the true owner of these tankers, it became increasingly difficult.
You have a shell company that owns a shell company that owns a shell company.
They would change names, national flags, owners.
And the reason that the true owner goes to such great length to be concealed is because often the true owner is the Kremlin or interests aligned with the Kremlin.
Analysts say these ships are used to transport Russian oil in defiance of Western sanctions, but many of them run routes to Iran and Venezuela, too.
These ships are interchangeable. They can run oil from all kinds of places. And if one place gets too hot, they'll shift and run oil to another.
Now Brooks says the U.S. blockade of Venezuela appears to be correlating with an uptick in Shadow Fleet tankers sailing that route.
It disrupts energy markets. It feeds money to autocratic, corrupt regimes that wage wars. It should be in the combined interest of the United States and Europe to work together to shut this Shadow Fleet down.
But that's easier said than done. There are about 1,000 Shadow Fleet tankers sailing today, explains Richard Mead, editor-in-chief of Lloyd's List Intelligence, a newspaper devoted to the maritime industry.
Because of the speed and the volume of these sanctioned trades, it's becoming increasingly difficult for governments to keep up with the pace of these operations.
One 2025 review by Lloyd's List estimated that more than 10% of oil tankers globally appear on sanctions lists. Many of them switch between Iranian, Russian, and Venezuelan oil trades. Much of the oil is sold to China and India.
The reason why the U.S. is so interested in Venezuela, it has large storage of oil, but specifically heavy sour grades of oil, very thick, viscous oil. And that's what the U.S. refineries are set up to deal with.
When an oil tanker known as the Bella One slipped through the U.S. blockade of Venezuela last month, it was flying the flag of Guyana. As it crossed the Atlantic Ocean, its crew hastily painted a Russian flag on its side and renamed it the Marinera, one of more than 20 Shadow Fleet ships that have reflagged to Russia in recent weeks, says Michelle Bachman of Windward AI.
They've gone to Comoros and Gambia and Sierra Leone, then they've been booted out of there. And so they've sort of run out of places to hide.
It looked like a last-ditch attempt to save the ship by claiming Russian protection. But U.S. troops boarded it anyway. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Fireworks are a part of New Year's Eve celebrations in many countries. In the Netherlands, there comes a reckoning after all the pyrotechnics. Every January, the Dutch government publishes a report detailing the injuries caused by fireworks at the turn of the new year. This year, the numbers are grim. 2 people were killed and more than 1,200 injured. There's hope that a forthcoming law will put an end to all this. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has more.
New Year's Eve kicked off in central Amsterdam this year with a spectacular fireworks display. But long after midnight, those distinctive crackles and bangs could be heard for hours across the Dutch capital. Several gangs of revelers also ended up in violent clashes with police.
It was a brutal start to the new year for Dutch police, who say they faced unprecedented violence on New Year's Eve. Emergency services were pelted with fireworks and even petrol bombs.
There are a lot of walk-ins with potentially very serious injuries like amputations or eye injuries.
Yara Basta is an emergency physician in Almere, about 30 kilometres outside of Amsterdam. A couple of years ago, she tells me she had a patient walk in on New Year's Eve, clutching their eyeball, after a firework blew it out of its socket. Many of her colleagues have dealt with a lot worse, she says.
Like shells or very heavy firework detonating very close to a person, so it's basically a blast injury like you see in a war zone.
The vast majority of those injured are young and male, she says. Basta, who's president of the Dutch Society of Emergency Physicians, supports a ban on consumer fireworks. The law, which is expected to come into effect this year, will ban people buying and setting off fireworks unless they have a license. Not everyone is sure it's such a good idea.
So I understand why they want it, but I don't understand we're doing it like in the Netherlands alone.
Yolanda Penn is co-founder of Dream Fireworks, the company that organised the official fireworks event in Amsterdam on New Year's Eve.
I know for sure if we have a ban this year, a lot of people will go to Germany, to Belgium, to Poland, to all the other countries to get fireworks because all the borders are open.
For the law to really work, Penn says, there needs to be a ban on consumer fireworks across the EU. And right now, that looks unlikely, as fireworks are hugely popular in other parts of the bloc too. The Dutch love for fireworks goes back to the 17th century, although in the last few decades it's become something of a national tradition on New Year's Eve for families and neighbours to get together and set off their own fireworks in local parks and streets. That came as something of a shock to River Airtree, who moved to the Netherlands from the US 2 years ago.
We just had no idea that it would be that volume, that close, and go on for so long. And the type of fireworks they were using, we just didn't think civilians had access to in the United States. They usually need an operator's license. So it was very surprising.
Airtree hosts a YouTube channel called Dutch Life Diaries with her husband Mark, all about navigating life as two Americans in the Netherlands. A few days ago, the couple posted a video comparing New Year's Eve celebrations in Brooklyn, where they used to live, with that of their newly adopted home.
So this is the view of the fireworks from our bedroom window in Brooklyn that we were so excited that we could see. And then this is the fireworks from our bedroom window in
Schiedam.
Yeah.
Airtree says they could hear explosives going off throughout the night, which he points out can be really stressful on their pets too.
We start using pheromone spray in the house a few days before New Year's to keep them calmer. And we stay home. We don't travel on that day, so we're home for them.
The Dutch political party, Party for the Animals, has been campaigning for a nationwide ban for the past 15 years. The law, though, will only take effect if a compensation package for fireworks sellers is agreed. Last year, the industry recorded sales of more than $150 million, and suppliers are asking for compensation more than six times that amount. Dutch politicians disagree over how much money should be paid out. Dr. Yarabasta says even if the ban goes ahead this year, she still expects to be treating firework-related injuries on New Year's Eve.
I don't think the year of the ban will be the year that we see zero firework injuries. I think it will take some time.
In the meantime, Basta says, the Dutch need to get more inventive about how they ring out the old and celebrate the new. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Speaking of fireworks, the trumpet stylings of Portuguese musician Jessica Pina will light up the sky. Pina got some attention on social media a few years ago for a live remix with her horn of the 90s chart-topping Say My Name from Destiny's Child.
Jessica Pina began playing trumpet at the age of eight. She says touring with Madonna and the way the Material Girl supported her on stage is one of the highlights of her career.
If you want a better sense of this young artist's vision, check out this other track where Pina improvises over a simple rhythm. This is Stoto Late Night. Portuguese trumpeter Jessica Pina brings us to the end of our show today.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Have a great evening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.